It's Monday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a horrific bombing in Turkey targets a wedding. Massive flooding still affects portions of Louisiana.
Rather than being in defensive mode now, where we're just trying to move forward, we're more on the offensive.
Californians are dealing with smoke and fire. Also ahead, the Rio Olympics are concluding, and ballet dances its way onto farms. It's all on today's International Edition. Turkey is again in shock, this time following the bombing of a wedding ceremony, killing at least 50 people and wounding more than 90. The attack in the city of Gaziantep, close to the Syrian border, is being blamed on Islamic State militants. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
All through Saturday night, ambulances rushed the wounded to hospitals across Gaziantep. Witnesses say a suicide bomber detonated explosives in a packed street of people dancing and celebrating a wedding. Along with children, the bride and groom are reported to be among the dead in Turkey's worst terror attack this year. Speaking the day after the attack, while surveying the damage, local resident Ibrahim Özdemir says people are in shock.
Çevre eş dostlarımızdan vardı, işte komşularımız vardı. Üzüntülüyüz, acı içerisindeyiz.
Our friends and neighbors were there. We are so sad and in pain. The attack is an atrocity, he said. We want to end these massacres. We are in pain, especially the women and children. Shortly after the attack, Deputy Prime Minister Mehmet Şimşek flew to Gaziantep, the city he represents. Şimşek took a defiant stance.
Bunlar yine huzur içerisinde hep birlikte.
The aim of terror is to scare the people, but we will not allow this, he said, adding that a suicide bombing was the likely cause. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said IS was the chief suspect, accusing the group of targeting Turkey's Kurdish minority and seeking to create ethnic divisions within the country. The wedding was attended by many Kurds in a Kurdish part of the city. Syrian Kurdish forces have inflicted a number of recent defeats on the jihadist group. IS was blamed for a series of suicide bombings of Kurdish targets, including the country's worst terror attack in the capital, Ankara, in October, in which nearly 100 people died while attending a pro-Kurdish rally. Gaziantep, where the latest attack occurred, is less than an hour's drive to the Syrian border and has been a main hub for jihadists entering Syria and for logistical support. In May, Islamic State was blamed for a suicide car bombing of the city's security headquarters. IS has not claimed responsibility for Saturday's bombing, but analysts say the group has a record of not doing so for bombings in Turkey. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Adding to the magnitude of the atrocity, Mr. Erdogan said initial evidence shows the bomber was between just 12 and 14 years old. The White House condemned the Gaziantep attack, saying the perpetrators of the barbaric act cynically and cowardly targeted a wedding. The statement on Sunday added that Vice President Joe Biden will visit Ankara Wednesday to reaffirm the U.S. commitment to work together with Turkey against the scourge of terrorism. It's time now for our social media segment. And as always, our G. Abby Lee joins me right here in the studio with what's trending online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The New York Post reported Huma Abedin worked at a Muslim journal for years. The publication is called the Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs, and where she worked as the assistant editor, and her mother remains the editor-in-chief. The New York Post called it a radical publication that opposed women's rights and blamed the U.S. for 9/11. As you know, Abedin is one of Clinton's top aides, and that's why the New York Post argued she might become the future White House chief of staff if Clinton wins.
Wow. Well, that could potentially help cement the Republican support for Clinton's rival, Donald Trump, but it also appears that he's in the hot seat, correct?
That is correct. The New York Times reported a lot of things coming out of New York today. Donald Trump's companies owe at least $650 million in debt. The report attempted to map out Trump's business empire and its web of assets, partnerships, loans, and debts, and his campaign had reported the Trump organization owed $350 million before, so That's a total of $334 million difference. Not slight difference at all.
Yeah, that's a pretty big difference. Mm-hmm. Well, what else happens to be trending?
Of course, we have to talk about the latest in the Rio Games. Two coaches for a Mongolian wrestler took off their clothes to protest a penalty point given to an Uzbek athlete that led him to win the bronze medal. And I guess a controversial point here is how they protested the official's decision, because, I mean, that's a pretty uncommon way, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you've covered sports for a long time.
Yes.
Is it common or no?
Not for the coaches to disrobe.
No. But on social media, it was explained by people who are familiar with the Mongolian culture that stripping off clothes means they feel cheated and robbed. So it's a way of saying, you took away all I have. Mm. This is all I got. Others still say it was a childish behavior nonetheless. But the general sentiment to this online debate seems to be that, yes, weird customs in America are normal elsewhere and vice versa. So it's just cultural differences. Jim, back to you.
Well, I guess that's like giving the shirt off your back. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. And you can tweet us your comments and questions to our Twitter stream at @VOA_IE. On Twitter, you will find myself and G there as well, at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Duterte threatens to withdraw Philippines from United Nations. North Korea demands return of, quote, human scum diplomat. U.S. woman sentenced in scheme to provide military equipment to China. Indian farmers battle with climate-smart agriculture. Asia rollout of Pokemon Go spurs lifestyle changes and a business boom. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. First responders are still efforting rescues and resident checks 7 days after historic flooding hit the U.S. state of Louisiana. In the flood-ravaged pockets of South Louisiana, mental scars are already showing on the youngest victims of a disaster that prompted more than 30,000 rescues and left an estimated 40,000 homes damaged. Deputy Stacy Rand, Louisiana State Fire Marshal.
Basically, we're just out here doing recovery. We're going door to door. If anyone's, unaccounted for, this is a tight-knit community, but, if anyone's missing or whatnot, we're just going through and making sure everyone's accounted for and taken care of.
Michelle Parrott, her husband, and 6 children, ages 6 to 17, have slept in cars, a shelter, and a hotel room in the week since they had to be rescued by boat.
Blake has autism. He's 17 years old. He's at the freshman high. Mentally, he's afraid anytime it rains that there's going to be another flood. He feels unsafe constantly. He's had a lot of breakdowns, and right now we can't even get him to his doctors. We've had trouble getting his medications in. The therapist flooded so that he's lacking in the emotional support he needs from professionals. And they're just all panicked and shocked and afraid, very afraid for the uncertain future.
And adding to the difficulties, Parrott also homeschools her children.
Total loss, total chaos, soaking wet, books everywhere, floating, half of it floated out of the house. None of the kids' comfort things either.
The flooding wrecked their home in Livingston Parish, where one official has estimated that 3/4 of the residences are a total loss after just 1 meter or under 1 meter of rain have fallen in 3 days. And as recovery efforts continue, so do the damage assessments. The Federal Emergency Management Agency says it has already dispersed more than $34 million in aid. President Barack Obama is to visit the Louisiana town of Baton Rouge on Tuesday. The White House says Mr. Obama is eager to see the impact of the floods, but he wants to make sure that his presence does not interfere with ongoing recovery efforts. Louisiana Commissioner of Administration Jay Darden said Saturday that state officials will be open in all parishes Monday for for the first time since the flooding began. A wind-driven fire in central California has forced the closing of the historic Hearst Castle. The fire in San Luis Obispo County has destroyed 48 structures and burned more than 8,000 hectares since August 13th. It's about 4 kilometers from the popular tourist attraction that houses a large art collection that once belonged to William Randolph Hearst. Meanwhile, officials say the blue-cut wildfire in Southern California that has destroyed more than 300 homes and outbuildings is now 80% contained. The fire has burned more than 15,000 hectares in the mountain areas of San Bernardino County, 120 kilometers northeast of Los Angeles. Kathy Mattingly of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection.
Rather than being in defensive mode now, where we're just trying to move forward, we're more on the offensive.
No deaths have been reported in the Blue Cut fire, officials said, adding that an investigation to the cause of the blaze continues. At its height, the wildfire threatened more than 34,000 homes. More than 82,000 residents were told to evacuate. Kathy Mattingly says some residents may soon be allowed back home.
The reason that the evacuations are still in place is because there are still areas that are threatened. Until we can get those containment lines constructed and provide that barrier between the burned area and the green to protect those communities. And so when they can actually be successful in getting those lines constructed, then they can release that.
Firefighters are battling at least 6 other wildfires in the western U.S. state. No deaths have been reported so far in this week's blaze. U.S. gymnast Simone Biles has been chosen by the U.S. athletes to carry the American flag in the Olympic closing ceremony that's supposed to take place just a short time from now in Rio de Janeiro. Biles, who took 4 golds and a bronze in this year's competition, called the decision an incredible honor. The final day of the Olympics featured 12 gold medal events, including men's basketball. Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge won the gold medal in the men's marathon. Kipchoge completed the race in 2 hours, 8 minutes, 44 seconds ahead of Ethiopia's Feyisa Lelisa and Galen Rupp of the United States. Clarissa Shields became the first American boxer of either gender to win gold medals in 2 consecutive Olympic competitions. In a unanimous decision, Shields defeated Nochuka Fontien of the Netherlands to win the middleweight title. Shields has not lost a fight now in more than 4 years. Also on Sunday, Russia captured the gold medal in the all-around rhythmic gymnastics, beating out Spain and third-place Bulgaria. Russia's Soslan Romanov won the gold medal at the 65 kilograms in men's freestyle wrestling tournament. Nino Schwerter of Switzerland won the mountain bike race, and the United States team easily coasted to gold in the matchup against Serbia in basketball to win 96-66. It is the U.S. team's 3rd consecutive gold medal. For the 6th consecutive Olympics, the U.S. women's basketball team won gold. VOA's Park Brewer was at Saturday's final in Rio.
The United States finished off a dominating performance at these Olympics, beating Spain in the gold medal match 101-72. Heading into the final, the U.S. women had been overpowering in Rio, winning their previous 7 games by an average margin of close to 40 points. And the high-scoring game against Spain was the 6th time in their 8 contests that they scored more than 100 points. U.S. coach Gino Auriemma said his team played basketball at a very high level at these Olympics.
Obviously, it was an incredible tournament for us. It wasn't as easy as sometimes it looked, you know, because of our depth and because of the experience that we have on our team. We were able to separate ourselves, but the way we played, we respected the opponents and we respected the game itself, and we earned a lot of respect from, I think, a lot of people around the world, and I'm really proud of that.
U.S. team captain and guard Sue Bird.
You can talk about the 100-point games and, you know, the margin of victory, but we played our butts off. I mean, we really did. I don't think I've ever been around a group that's this talented and also played this hard.
That's quite a compliment, because Bird has been playing for the U.S. national team since 2002, and this is her 4th Olympic gold medal. Despite the loss, the Spanish players, like Ana Cruz, said they can hold their heads high because the silver is their nation's first Olympic medal in women's basketball. She said this was the most important day in her sporting life.
because I've been for 15 years in the national team, and this is my third Olympic Games, and to be in this podium and have this silver medal, for me, it's everything.
In the bronze medal game played earlier Saturday, Serbia defeated France 70-63. Perk Brewer, VOA News at the Rio Olympics.
Meanwhile, U.S. Olympic Committee CEO Scott Blackmon said Sunday 12-time swimming medalist Ryan Lochte and his three teammates who claimed they were robbed will face disciplinary action. Blackmon did not offer specifics but expressed frustration over their behavior.
I think that we all understand that they let down our athletes, they let down Americans, and they really let down our hosts in Rio, who did such a wonderful job, and we feel very badly about that. I think we've ended up in the right place in terms of being able to shine a light on what really happened there, and we are going to have further action on this when we get back to the United States. So I don't want to say anything about the specifics of the case, but I think we all understand what happened at this point and understand that the things that were said the people of Rio just weren't true.
Ryan Lochte admitted Saturday he over-exaggerated assertions he and three teammates were the victims of an armed robbery at a Rio de Janeiro gas station. He insisted, however, he did not lie, but still issued an apology. Lochte maintained he was a victim of blackmail because he was forced by armed guards to give them money. Swimmer Gunnar Benz said the guards accosted them after they had urinated behind some bushes and Lochte had ripped an advertising poster from a wall. The Olympic Games in 2020 will be held in Tokyo, Japan, where preparations have been underway since it was awarded the competition in 2013. Tokyo beat out Istanbul, Turkey, and Madrid, Spain, for the right to host the 2020 Games, which will feature five sports that were not held in Rio de Janeiro. Those sports: baseball, softball, climbing, karate, skateboarding, and surfing. So if you're good at any one of those, you've got 4 years to start training for Tokyo. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Ballet lovers in Vermont are getting a taste of the art form in a very different way: outdoors on farms. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the Farm to Ballet project helps audiences learn about and enjoy fresh from the field foods.
The setting is bucolic. Wide, lush fields, farm animals, a clear sky, a setting sun, and giant leaves of lettuce? This performance by the Farm to Ballet Company in Pulteney, Vermont, has dancers portraying plants, including giant lettuce leaves. The corps de ballet is dressed in green, and the dancers wave giant green and purple leaves in time to the music. Dancers dressed as tomatoes, farm animals, and farmers are helping to tell the story of the growing season. The 25 dancers range in age from 18 to 74. Some are professionals, but many of them are amateurs. Dancer Lindsay Hullman says performing in the open air, in someone's front yard or farm field, is not exactly the same as being in a theater.
You never know what kind of surface you're going to be dancing on, and so we always are surprised by, you know, you might go to PK and your foot might not be exactly where you thought it was going to be, like it is inside in a studio or on a stage. So there's always the surprises of the natural surroundings and the every you know, space we've danced in is so different. So I think each experience is very unique. So that's a challenge. It's different from if you performed on a stage and you're very, you know, consistently performing in the same spot.
Chach Preger, the Farm to Ballet Project's artistic director, says the event aims to immerse the audience in the atmosphere of the farm.
One of the most exciting things about this event is the depth of experience that it encompasses, the food that you're eating on the farm, the beautiful farms, venues that we use, the show. We really access all of our senses and bring them together into one experience. I think that becomes real powerful.
The Farm to Ballet troupe emerged out of a summer class the dancers took one year. They didn't want to go inside, so they practiced in a park, and they learned they actually could dance on grass. Audience member Jess Palachik says that she enjoyed the sunset performance.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I'm fascinated by ballet in general, mostly because I can't do it myself, so to see someone else do it, and to see so many locals come together and do that, along with outside talent, I'm pretty sure, was really cool to see.
Dinner made from locally grown ingredients was offered before the show. Some audience members brought their own picnics to eat on the grass. The Farm to Ballet Project aims to raise money for agriculture while widening the audience for classical ballet. 75% of ticket sales go to the host farm or to agricultural nonprofit groups. The dancers have a total of 8 performances this summer at various farms around Vermont. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
We thank you for listening to International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia Patricia Haslak participated in a signing ceremony in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, August 11, 2016, to award a Julia Taft Fund grant for refugees to International Rescue Committee Ethiopia. The U.S. government is proud to partner with government, international organizations, and NGOs like IRC to support Ethiopia as it hosts the largest population of refugees in Africa. The importance of Ethiopia as a key player in responding to refugee needs is highlighted by the fact that Ethiopia will serve as one of 7 co-hosts for President Obama's Leaders Summit on Refugees that will be held on September 20th in conjunction with the 71st session of the UN General Assembly. The summit co-hosts all recognize that the international community must do more to protect and assist refugees. Massive numbers of refugees are embarking upon dangerous paths in search of safety, and millions more face long-term waits in first asylum countries with limited and, in some cases, no access to lawful employment and education while they wait for crises to end in their respective countries. In the lead-up to the UNGA, Ethiopia, the United States, and other co-hosts, as well as other UN member states that join this effort, will make concrete commitments to address these challenges. In 2015, the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration provided nearly $82 million in refugee assistance in Ethiopia, and to date this year has provided over $66 million. Through its assistance in Ethiopia, the United States funding for IRC has allowed it to implement projects that have renovated facilities for the reception of children and adolescent refugees arriving in Ethiopia, developed livelihoods for refugees, and constructed a multipurpose women's center for counseling, training, and community activities. The Department of State is delighted that IRC is the recipient of this year's Julia Taft Fund Award in Ethiopia. This award of nearly $25,000 will boost the availability of safe drinking water and improve sanitation facilities for the 21,000-plus refugees, mostly from Sudan and South Sudan, who live in the Soar and Shekoli refugee camps. The U.S. government looks forward to continuing to fostering our partnership and commitment with IRC, as well as with our other NGO and international organization partners, to assist the refugee population in Ethiopia.
That was an editorial reflecting...